Welcome to Intelligent Systems, the podcast of the Institute for Intelligent Systems at the University of Memphis. I'm your host, Dr. Leah Windsor. I'm the director of the Institute for Intelligent Systems and an associate professor of applied linguistics at the University of Memphis. I study language and society. My work explores the question, how does what we say reveal who we are? In this podcast, we will explore the dynamics of intelligent systems, including interactions between and among humans, computers, and groups of sentient and non-sentient beings. The Institute for Intelligent Systems has three key areas: language, learning, and artificial intelligence. We will explore and define what an intelligent system is and talk about intelligent systems in practice across these three issue areas. Today's guest is Dr. Andrew Olney. Dr. Olney presently serves as professor in both the Institute for Intelligent Systems and Department of Psychology at the University of Memphis. He received a BA in Linguistics and Cognitive Science from University College London in 1998, an MS in Evolutionary and Adaptive Systems from the University of Sussex in 2001, and a PhD in Computer Science from the University of Memphis in 2006. Dr. Olney has over 100 publications in the fields of artificial intelligence, education, and psychology, with a particular focus on using natural language processing to assess and enhance learning from text and learning through conversation. He's been an investigator on $18 million in federal grants, $6 million as PI in these fields. His primary research interests are in language, interfaces, and artificial intelligence. Welcome to the Intelligent Systems Podcast, Andrew. We are so glad to have you as our guest.
I'm glad to be here.
So to get started, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? What's your academic career and your academic story?
Sure. So you already covered the degrees. So I guess I would go back a little bit. So when I was a kid, I was always really interested in computers. So my dad was a systems engineer for IBM, and so we always had computers in the house. So when I was 4 years old, I was using an Apple II Plus that had the 64K memory expansion from 32K. And then when I was about seven, I was actually programming. So he had bought a book for my brother that was programming in BASIC. And so I would just kind of copy it out and write some programs, right? So, you know, I had computers and stuff going through high school. I was even interested in artificial intelligence. I tried to get my dad to buy me a Lisp compiler, like a Lisp software for the Mac at that point, which he wouldn't do. It was like $350, which back then was a lot of money.
Yeah.
But I had, you know, books on artificial intelligence and C and some stuff like that. Not that I fully understood them, but, you know, like there was the interest was there.
Yeah.
I got interested more in language and psychology when I was in high school. And I got really interested in the relationship between language and thought. So that's why I decided to do linguistics with cognitive science and did that. Got into neural networks, so basically natural language processing with neural networks. Continued that into my master's degree where I was trying to evolve those neural networks. Then actually got really fed up with neural networks because they just, you couldn't really do a lot with them back then. Like the computers were just not fast enough and you just didn't have enough data. So I was, you know, finished my master's degree and I was looking for a job, came back to the U.S. and saw on the linguist list a job as a consultant for the Institute for Intelligent Systems. So I reached out. So Max had put out the ad, Max Lauers. So I reached out, had a conversation with him, and ended up working as a consultant for, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. And then somewhere, like a monthly contract. And then somewhere in there, Max said, hey, would you do a PhD? Because if you came back, we would pay for your PhD and we would keep paying you like money on the side. And I was like, really? That's like a thing? And he was like, yeah, that's the way it works. I said, oh, okay. So I started a PhD in computer science. So there wasn't really a program that was well aligned with me at the University of Memphis. The computer science program here is pretty traditional. At the time, it was even more traditional. And so I basically worked with Art Gracer, like on his research projects, which were all intelligent tutoring systems, you know, the AI, natural language processing associated with that, while I was doing courses and so forth in the computer science department. And then after that, I was, you know, going to graduate, and Art said, hey, do you want to be the associate director for the IIS for a year as like a visiting? And I said, sure. And I'd gone out on the job market and stuff. And then the next year, they did a permanent search for that position, which I ended up, actually wasn't the top candidate, but the top candidate. They couldn't pay the top candidate as much money as the top candidate wanted. So top candidate turned them down, and they made the offer to me, and I accepted it.
There you go.
And yes, the rest is history.
That's right.
Yeah.
Huh. So what do you think an intelligence system is after working in this for however many years? What's an intelligent system?
Yeah, I think it's a really difficult question to answer because it's a little bit like answering, like, what is life?
Mm.
What does it mean for something to be alive?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you get into, like, for life, you get into all sorts of interesting questions like, okay, well, does it replicate itself?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So can something be alive and have all the properties of life if it doesn't replicate itself?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is a crystal that grows, is it alive?
Mm.
It grows.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of replicates itself
mm-hmm.
by growing more crystal.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so we, you know, biologists have come up with all these kind of loose rules for what constitutes something being alive. And
right.
I think for intelligence, it's kind of similar.
Yeah.
And when you talk about human intelligence, that's quite easy to do.
Right.
But when you start talking about, like, human intelligence, you know, so, you know, is a dog intelligent? Okay. Is a worm intelligent? Right. Is a bacteria intelligent? Is a virus intelligent? And
uh-huh.
I'm still just using living
yeah,
things,
yeah.
right? And then, you know, you start talking about artificial systems, right? Is a light switch intelligent?
Mm.
Is a thermostat intelligent?
Mm-hmm.
Right? At what point do we start saying it's intelligent? So
mm-hmm.
I think there's, for me, I look at it as kind of a continuum
mm-hmm.
Of intelligence. And so it's not necessarily like a sharp definition
mm-hmm.
of, okay, at this point, things are intelligent, but more
mm-hmm.
of a graded
mm-hmm.
graded approach. And for me personally, I tend to focus on things that are on the higher end,
mm-hmm.
right? So closer to humans, AI that can perform tasks that are comparable to human performance. That's the kind of stuff that I'm interested in.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you know, what's an example from your work and your research that would qualify as an intelligent system or that you would describe as an intelligent system?
Well, so the really early stuff that I was working on with art and intelligent tutoring systems, I would call that an intelligent system. So
mm-hmm.
you have a an AI that's acting in the role as a human tutor,
mm-hmm.
and that AI has objectives of what
mm-hmm.
it wants you to learn,
mm-hmm.
and it has a conversation with you to figure out what you know, and then based on its determination of what you know, it decides how it's going to teach you the content,
mm-hmm.
right? So we... Early on, we did this a lot for, like, physics, and then, you know, I ended up doing it with biology, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are just a bunch of different domains we applied it to. So it's an intelligent system in the sense that it can make decisions,
mm-hmm.
has a certain amount of autonomy in deciding how to adapt
mm-hmm.
to what the human needs. But yeah, I mean, you could also have systems that can hold a conversation, but they're not really intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, one of the really famous ones is Eliza.
Yeah.
So, you know, Eliza from, like, the 60s, it would just echo back to you the things that you were saying. And so this worked because the way that they framed what it was doing was as a Rogerian
uh-huh.
psychotherapist,
uh-huh.
where that's what Rogerian psychotherapists are supposed to do.
Right.
They're supposed to be non-directional, just reflect back what you're saying.
Right.
So, you know, they chose this really simple technology, really simple approach, but then they wrapped it up with this this kind of framing where it seemed intelligent in that context.
Uh-huh.
So it just kind of gives you a sense of, like, you know, when they package it that way, sure, it seems like it's intelligent because it's kind of doing what it's supposed to do.
Right.
But really, they took something that couldn't do anything else and they just found a use case for it
right.
where it suddenly... it kind of made sense and it kind of worked.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of those things that makes it difficult to determine what is an intelligent system. And, you know, it kind of makes it subjective.
Hmm.
It can be intelligent in some contexts, but not intelligent in others.
So I have two more questions about this particular theme. One is, in your experience with intelligent tutoring systems, is there learning involved? Is the AI updating its priors and acquiring or integrating the feedback from the human in the loop
yeah.
into that?
So there's actually, for those old intelligent tutoring systems,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, we're talking about 25 years old now.
Yeah.
There's actually a couple of different kinds of learning.
Mm-hmm.
So one kind of learning was the latent semantic analysis
right.
space, which these days we call embeddings, or
right.
vector space, or whatever. But this was a pre-neural network approach to transforming words and language into vectors. And so that's how these tutoring systems would understand what you were saying. They would take what you were saying, they'd map it onto a vector,
mm-hmm.
and they'd compare that vector to what it expected you to say,
mm-hmm.
basically. So there was learning there that was done up front,
right.
and that was the learning that was required to understand language. Then during runtime, there was another kind of learning, which is where it would assess what you were saying. It would model what the student, I'll just call the user the student,
mm-hmm.
analyze what the student was saying, and then basically build a model of what the student would know.
Hmm.
And so in that sense, it was learning what the student knows, and it would probe, so it would diagnostically ask questions in order to probe what the student knows.
Right.
So that would say, okay, I have a certain level of confidence that you know these things,
mm-hmm.
and for these other things, I have low confidence that you know them. So then it would decide, okay, let's not talk about these things that you know, let's talk about these things that I think you don't know.
Got you.
So that it would do that kind of learning in real time. And I also worked on some stuff later on where I was trying to kind of blur the boundary between the LSA part
uh-huh.
that I mentioned, the upfront learning, and the like real-time learning
yep.
by having the tutoring system learn what it was going to teach while it was interacting with people.
Oh.
So it would be like a self-bootstrapping intelligent tutoring system.
Uh-huh.
That turned out to not work that great.
Uh-huh.
Because basically most people, when they're talking to this kind of thing, they don't want to put in the kind of extra work to teach it. Really, they just want to use it as a tool. So they want it to be ready to go out of the box. So it's actually only a small number of people will put in the effort to like correct things that it says that are wrong, which actually has some implications for how people interact with ChatGPT and other large language models today.
So sub question before I get to my next part of that, does the intelligent tutoring system mirror the syntax or the language structure of the student that it's interacting with, or does it have a fixed syntactic mental model?
Yeah, that's a super interesting question. So the way that we did this in tutoring systems that we evaluated, it was always a fixed syntax. There was some work that I did on mirroring. So some of the mirroring work would be like nonverbal mirroring on the part of the agent. So we would have these animated agents so that the tutor wouldn't be like a voice talking to you. You would actually see a character, like a cartoon type character, sometimes much more realistic, that would be talking to you with synthesized speech and gestures and, you know, emoting and things like that. So there were versions that we made where it would mirror your posture. So if you leaned in, it would lean in. If you smiled, it would smile, you know, things like that. So we did some of that nonverbal mirroring. And then with some work with Rick Dale,
oh, yeah.
back around, I want to say like maybe 2010, 2012, we did look at kind of like syntactic priming.
Okay.
Type work,
yeah.
Where, yeah, it was like Garrett and Pickering,
okay.
so more of the kind of thing that you're talking about. But that never made its way into an intelligent tutoring system. We just, you know, we did experiments where we kind of looked at that by itself. But yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. There's some aspects to that which I think are important because it can help build rapport between the AI and the user.
Uh-huh.
But from a learning perspective, it's not clear how important that is. So this is one of those things you get
yeah.
at where it's like, it may be important for them to keep coming back to learn,
mm-hmm.
but it's not necessarily that important for like what they're learning right now.
Got you.
Yeah.
I've wondered about this, you know, there's in the experimental design world, you know, where participants are given something to read that's from one or another newspaper, and it's written, you know, by the researcher, by the scholar. I've wondered about how similar the syntax is in the prompt that the person is reading, and if that actually reflects maybe the reading grade level or the syntactic simplicity or complexity of the actual newspaper. And I mean, it's kind of in the weeds at this point in this conversation, but, you know, how relevant is it maybe in the ELIZA, you know, kind of framework that they're speaking like you or to you?
Yeah, no, I think it's a really important question. So I can't remember some of the references on this because it's been a while, but some of the kind of alignment that happens linguistically, so, you know, syntactic priming and whatnot,
yeah,
it happens very quickly.
Yeah.
And then it also can have a sustained effect.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you could read something or hear someone's, you know, speech, communicate with someone.
Right.
And then it could affect, like, the syntactic constructions you choose to use, like, a day later.
Yes.
So it's really interesting and really, it's quick and has a long duration of effect.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not really clear how it might influence, say, like, the decisions that you make.
Right.
Or how easy it is to learn things.
Uh-huh.
That's when you start getting into this, like, language and thought kind
right,
of stuff.
Right.
And it's just very, you know, it's very hard to analyze and come up with something conclusively. Because,
yes,
like, in any moment, you know, you could, and this is a simple example, you could say, Andrew, I'm going to give you a word. Tell me the first five words that come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
So you say robin, mm-hmm, and I might say worm or egg or something like that, right? So the first couple of words that I say, you know, those might be influenced by primes, like,
right,
if I saw an egg early in the day or worm. But that doesn't necessarily mean that because I said those things first, like, my fundamental concept of what a robin is has changed.
Right.
It's just, you know, those are the, I can only say one word at a time, and those are just the words that came out first.
Right.
So it's just, you get into, like, some of these really kind of interesting, very subtle issues.
Right.
Probably, you know, that might be an interesting thing to look at with neuroscience, put people on a brain scanner.
Mm-hmm.
It might be that you would need to do that kind of research to really, mm-hmm, get at some of those questions.
When you said Robin, I thought Winnie the Pooh.
Okay. Christopher Robin.
Right.
Nice. Yeah.
Okay, so now to my actual second question. What's the system part? How do you think about, like, I get the intelligence part, but how do you think about the system aspect of intelligent systems? Like, where is the system?
All right, yeah, where's the boundary? So,
yeah,
you know, I think the boundary is, again, murky.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously when you're talking about any kind of animal, then you could say, okay, well, one boundary is the skin.
Mm-hmm.
So where does the animal stop?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, then if you've got groups of animals that are working together, like people,
mm-hmm,
or a pack of wolves or, you know, something like that,
mm-hmm,
a flock of birds.
Yeah.
Like, even a flock of birds, they're
bees,
not really working together, and yet a flock of birds has a kind of emergent behavior.
Yes.
Right? Of how they, each bird is following a couple of simple rules about how not to collide with other birds.
Right.
And as a result, you get this, you know, giant swarm,
right,
that maintains a certain kind of cohesive shape and so on and so forth. Schools,
right,
of fish, stuff like that.
Right.
So, you know, then the system goes beyond the individual organism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can say the same thing for, you know, a person working with a computer, working with a tool,
mm-hmm,
you know, now together they're some kind of system.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think it gets kind of subjective. I think the definitions are difficult. I think at the end of the day, like, from a scientific point of view, what really matters is, does defining it this way, like the saying that these two things together are a system, does that give you some sort of explanatory power that you didn't have before?
Mm-hmm.
Or does it not?
Mm-hmm.
Because if it doesn't give you any sort of explanatory power, then it's not very, you can say, yeah, this is a system, but it's not very interesting and it's not very useful.
Right.
But if now, by saying, okay, this is a system, then it lets you, like, make predictions that you really couldn't make before or get some sort of insight that you couldn't get before, then, yeah, okay, then it probably makes sense to say that it's a system. And in psychology, you have, I think, kind of a similar thing with psychological constructs. You can make up all of these psychological constructs, but if they don't actually do anything useful or predict anything, then it's like, okay, it's a construct, but it's not really that interesting because either you can't test it or it doesn't have any sort of explanatory benefit beyond what you already have.
Yeah. I was thinking about that in the context of Sean Gallagher's work on the 4E cognition, the embedded, extended,
inactive,
and I always forget one. It's like the four agreements. I can never remember all of the four agreements. I never remember all the same three. Okay, so there's this amazing story about the head of Philip K. Dick. Please, start to finish. What is this story? Tell us about it.
Yeah. Again, this is kind of in the midst of time. So it was probably around 2004, I would say. I think Art Gracer met David Hansen at a conference, I think. And I think Art invited David to come to Memphis. Like Art had talked about Autotutor. So David, background. So David Hansen is an artist. He worked at Disney Imagineering at one point. And he was doing these robotic sculptures.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, very, very high fidelity animatronics of the human face.
Mm-hmm.
So far beyond anything that you would see at Disney or whatever.
Like right.
These are very, very lifelike, like beyond what you would see in movie special effects. Because in movie special effects, they would just do it all digitally.
Right.
Right? It wouldn't be worth it to create something as elaborate as what David was doing. And then David also used this this kind of skin that was kind of like a trade secret of his to make the skin very lifelike. I'm not entirely sure what it was.
I think it was
some sort of silicone product that he had maybe introduced some sort of bubbles into it by vacuuming or something like that to give it a kind of porosity. But I'm really not sure. He never told me, and I never really probed. But anyway, David came to visit. I think he brought one of the robots he was working on. We kind of talked a little bit. You know, David was really interested in artificial intelligence to drive these things.
Right.
Because, I mean, he could puppet them, but he wanted an AI to drive it, right?
Yeah.
And, of course, we had all the speech synthesis, interactive AI stuff that we were working on with Autotutor, just not a robot.
Right.
So we had a conversation. I ended up making a version of Autotutor that was running through a Billy Bass talking fish, which you can still see on YouTube. It's one of my top YouTube videos. So, you know, this is the fish that's now talking to you.
Right.
Yeah, so that was pretty neat. So anyway, somewhere around in there, David and I started talking, and we thought, okay, well, we can try to do something together. So what that eventually kind of manifested in, there was a kind of step along the way with Eva. I really can't remember exactly when that was. But where that ended up with was the head of Philip K. Dick, or the Philip K. Dick android. So I think David actually came to me and he said, hey, what do you think of this idea? And I was like, that's an amazing idea. Because I like science fiction, and Philip K. Dick has lots of stories and books about robots that act human and humans that act like robots, right?
Uh-huh.
So kind of like, where's the boundary? Like,
right.
what does it mean to be human, which is just a common kind of sci-fi
right.
kind of theme.
Right, right, right.
And so we did that. So the kind of target was Wired Next Best.
Mm-hmm.
So David, on his side, he teamed up with a bunch of people in Texas. I think ARI. So it's like a engineering institute over at University of Texas Arlington.
Mm-hmm.
And they helped with like 3D printing.
Mm-hmm.
I think they professionalized a lot of the stuff that David had been doing that was more of kind of a like artist level.
Mm-hmm.
And then on my side, I did like all of the AI for it,
mm-hmm.
using some ideas from like Autotutor, but just a bunch of like other stuff that I had been thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
So again, using like LSA. So one of the things that we did or that I did that was kind of interesting is I got a bunch of Philip K. Dick books, maybe about 20 of those, got them all scanned and created a vector space or an embedding space of Philip K. Dick books. Another thing that was interesting is that there were conversations with Philip K. Dick that had been published. So at one point in time, people would go over to his house, slap a tape recorder on the table, and just start talking to him and record it and then transcribe it and write all the stuff down. So I built like multiple models of interaction for Philip K. Dick that used all of these things together. So one was, okay, there are these existing conversations. If somebody asks a question or says something and it's very similar to something that was previously said,
right,
just come back with whatever Philip K. Dick's answer was. Easy peasy. I also had a kind of a chat bot that I would that used for like the kinds of questions that people normally ask.
Right.
Because most people who walk up to a robot like that, they just ask like the same 100 questions. Yeah, like what's your favorite color? What's your favorite food? What's your favorite movie? What's your name? When were you born? You know, just stuff like that.
Huh.
You know, just kind of random stuff.
Okay.
And so all that I tried to account for in a chat bot. And then the most interesting thing I did was I would use a kind of AI driven summarization model,
mm-hmm,
that would use these embeddings and try to come up with basically a new generative,
mm-hmm,
sentence that would essentially merge together little units of text scattered from all these different sources.
Right.
So it would really be generating something new. And that was actually pretty cool, but it took like 10 or 20 seconds, depending, for it to generate something.
Uh-huh.
So when we actually demoed the robot, we turned that model off, and then we had a model voting procedure where it would generate all these different candidates of things, uh-huh, to say, and then we would have, then there was an algorithm that would select the best one.
Uh-huh.
And that's what we did for real-time interaction. So anyway, the robot, you could talk to it. Sometimes it would respond with really great Philip K. Dick stuff. I've got videos on YouTube of that.
Uh-huh.
We took it to Wired Next Fest. It got a lot of media attention, international, uh-huh, attention. David went on and got it put on a Korean robot body.
Hmm.
And that became the Albert Einstein robot. I think Hubo robot. Anyway, and then we went to AAAI,
mm-hmm,
and won a robotics competition there in AAAI, Open Interaction. I've got some videos of that. And then we were invited to a talk at Google. So David had been working, I think he was coming back from Korea. It might have been somewhere else in Asia. He'd been working with some people, and he was flying to the thing in Google, which was Mountain View.
Mm-hmm.
And the robot was in an overhead like carry-on bag.
Yeah.
He fell asleep on the plane, and so when he woke up, they were deplaning, and he just grabbed what was like at the floor level, whatever bag he had, and he left it on the plane. And so it got lost and it was never found. So, you know, we had already arrived in Mountain View. We were waiting for him to show up, and then found out, you know, we're sitting there at Google and he's like at the airport and everything, freaking out. So we ended up doing the talk at Google without the head, and the head was never found again. So it was never seen again. David Duffy wrote a book about it a couple of years later. So this is all kind of chronicled in that
book. Oh my
book.
Gosh.
So yeah, pretty funny. I mean, one of my, like, I've got some theories on it, but I think my favorite theory is what I call the Ark of the Covenant theory.
Oh,
which
oh,
is that
yeah.
The head actually ended up like in a wooden crate and some sort of like airport, you know, storage facility. And then, you know, the power of the head, the full, you know, the pink laser beam from outer space,
uh-huh,
like burned off the lettering on the side of the crate,
right,
so it could never be found, right? So it's just there somewhere, right? Maybe in 1,000 years someone will rediscover it.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, so that was interesting. You know, learned a little bit from that. I think it was definitely an interesting experience, and it took me in some slightly different directions as far as AI was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But not tremendously that different, because at the end of the day, a lot of the natural language stuff was just highly related to things I had already been working on.
Right.
So, you know, whether it's whether you're having a conversation with a computer-based agent that has a little animated character on a screen versus a robot,
mm-hmm,
you know, just kind of boils down to what signals are you sending to control, you know, the servos versus the facial expressions on the animated character or whatever.
Yeah.
It's kind of, at a certain level, it's all kind of the same.
Well, so thinking about artificial intelligence in general, what do you think people are getting right and what do you think people are missing?
Yeah, definitely an interesting time. I think the main thing that people are missing is the history and the big ideas. So I think a lot of people are probably getting their information from the media.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the media portrayal of AI is it's like a cartoon, right? I mean, like, how much are you going to be able to convey in, like, just a short piece?
A bit reductionist.
And so, yeah. So AI has been around for a really long time.
Right.
Depending on how you look at it, hundreds or thousands of years, right? Depends on how far back you want to go. And so, you know, large language models are super impressive. There's a lot of things they can do. There's a lot of things they can't do. But they're not AI, right? They're just the latest thing that's happening in AI. So it's a little bit unfortunate, I think, because I think it keeps people from having a fuller understanding of what AI is to just focus on these things.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I think it, you know, if they focus just on those things, then they get a false sense of what the capabilities of AI are,
uh-huh.
right? So, you know, like, large language models in general don't do math very well, right? You need some sort of add-on for them
right.
to route the math through. And that's just a very kind of obvious and expected thing that comes from them being language models.
Right.
Right. But that's not what we, you know, that's not what we use AI for in general. If we want to do calculations, we use a calculator or whatever, right?
Right.
Like, that kind of calculation was solved decades ago. So, yeah, just there's a lot of kind of weird, I think, kind of distortion around it, unfortunately. But I'm glad that AI is getting some, you know, broader attention, and maybe more people will get interested in AI and get into it. So hopefully we'll have an evolving understanding.
So is it kind of like when you're doing first year statistics and you learn OLS and then you just over apply it to everything? And
yeah, what's a good analogy? It's kind of a tough one. This is maybe a weird example, but I'll just say this because it's the first thing that comes to mind.
Okay.
So something that was really important for computers and really important for a lot of our modern life was magnetic storage.
Mm-hmm.
So here's my understanding of magnetic storage. Of course, I can't remember some of the names involved. It came along with the invention of the telephone answering machine. Right, which
mm-hmm,
is invented at
mm-hmm,
Bell Labs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So someone's like, hey, check this out. I created this device that when people call and you're not home to answer your phone, it'll talk to them and it'll record a message, right?
Right.
But the thing that really made it amazing was not that they had invented the answering machine, it was that they had invented magnetic storage
right.
in order to record like what the person was saying,
right?
Because that had not previously existed,
right?
And then some managers at Bell Labs were like, yeah, that's creepy. People don't want to have their voices recorded. You need to stop working on this and work on something else, right? And so then magnetic storage just kind of hung out there for a long time, and it
uh-huh.
wasn't until later, I don't know if it was 10 years later or 20 years later,
right.
that people started. So, you know, I kind of feel like in a way some of the attention around like large language models is a little bit like that. So it's like
uh-huh.
the thing that's interesting about it is not what it's not the answering machine.
Right.
The thing that's interesting about it
technology.
Is the magnetic storage.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people need to stop focusing on the answering machine and focus more on the magnetic storage.
Got you.
Because it's the magnetic storage that's going to be important later.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can kind of look at it and it's like they're, you know, if you don't kind of understand it, it's kind of inseparable.
Right.
So
last question here. You're retiring very soon. In your last semester here at the U of M, what are you reflecting on? What are you thinking about?
I'm actually so busy, I'm not really reflecting on that much. I'm actually, I've got a bunch of old papers that I haven't gotten to writing up that I'm
mm-hmm.
in the process of writing up, like right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really focused on just like the work and getting as much of the work done as possible before I go. So yeah, maybe I'll have more time to be reflective later.
Post-retirement.
Right now it's like work and sleep and not as much time for reflection as maybe there should be.
Huh.
We'll see.
Well, maybe post-retirement we'll have you back on and see what you're reflecting on.
We can talk about chickens.
Perfect. Awesome. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your time this afternoon and for joining us on the Intelligent Systems Podcast.
My pleasure.
To learn more about the Institute for Intelligent Systems, please visit iis.memphis.edu. Theme music for the Intelligent Systems Podcast was created by Jason David Cooper.